So, Ryland, I hear we won another telly award. Can you show the kids at home our telly?
Our second telly.
We also won a communicator award a couple of years ago, but that's not a naked flying man.
Yeah, it's not. The naked flying man is like very handsome. I like it. Is it a man? Is it a woman? I don't know. Like very shapely in any case. I'm very attracted to this award.
The naked flying person. Or yeah, possibly so an angel.
That's two tellies. Very prestigious. The first one was for our audio podcast, available correct. On Apple Pods and wherever you get your fine ear crack. The second one was for our video debut on our brand new Half Evil Comics YouTube channel. If you are watching
this very moment, yes.
Well, they could be. So if you're watching at this very moment, smash that like button, tell a friend. If you are listening, head on over to the Half Evil Comics YouTube channel and subscribe, because then you get to see our beautiful faces and you get to see our very shapely award. You get to see everything I'm talking about. So
yeah, if you're just listening, you can't enjoy the sight of the naked flying telly person.
Yeah. So come on to YouTube and check it out. Hello and welcome to the Writer's Block, season 5 of the 2-time Telly Award-winning podcast. Coming at you like one Kenneth Clark Loggins, about to cut loose, foot loose, playing with the boys, taking that highway through the danger zone. I am Ryland Grant, call sign Telly. I'm also a screenwriter, a Ringo Award-winning creator of fine comics like Aberrant, Banjax, The Jump, and The Peacekeepers, which just wrapped up on Kickstarter. You can actually go over there and late pledge it right now if you want to do it. The other voice in the dark, the man in the box to the left, if you're watching on our beautiful YouTube channel, is?
David Avalone, call sign Coffee Achiever, and writer of comics and other things, but also comics.
Nice. I need to get in the habit of just being like, talk to me, Coffee Achiever. It's good. That's kind of a deep cut. Some will get that, some won't. I can tell you that if you die in a horrific accident, when I toss your dog tags into the ocean, I will do a much better job than did Tom Cruise.
Who
threw like a, I don't want to say threw like a girl, because I know some girls that just throw smoke, but he threw like a person who had literally never had to throw anything in his entire life, and it's embarrassing. And this is the guy that jumps like helicopter to helicopter and all these things. But, you know, I don't know, Tom, maybe throw a baseball a couple of times.
As Clint Eastwood said, a man has to know his limitations. And for Tom Cruise, maybe it's throwing dog tags into the ocean. Maybe that's just the one thing he does not do well.
Yeah. And Clint bumped up against talking to chairs and stuff like that. So, I mean, we all have our words.
Clint's bad with furniture. Tom's bad with baseballs. That's how it goes sometimes.
There you go, our mini limitations. But I was going to say, if you missed any of our previous conversations, episodes featuring comic luminaries like David F. Walker, Matt Fraction, Stan Sakai, Kevin Eastman, Rodney Barnes, and many more, our entire catalog can be celebrated via iTunes and other purveyors of worthwhile ear crack, and they are showing up slowly but surely here on the YouTube channel. So look out for our back issues episodes, which are always awesome. But we have a very, do you have something to pimp before we bring our illustrious guests on?
Sure. I think the day that this episode comes out, my comic Red Sonja Noir will be on the stands, which is a 30-page special from Dynamite, that throws Red Sonja into a classic mystery plot that, fans of classic mystery plots will recognize.
Nice.
That is the very next thing. And the weekend after that, I'm doing something called Turtle Con at Comics and Cocktails in Burbank, California on the 21st. Sure. You?
Wow. T-U-R-T-L-E power. I will be at Turtle Con as a fan, asking you for an autograph on something maybe. go back and get the Peacekeepers. Half Evil Comics has, I don't know, about 5 huge announcements coming, but I don't think we're ready to make them yet. So I will hold off on that. But we got good stuff coming. Follow the channel, follow the social media. We got a lot of big and bad stuff coming, but we're talking too much. We're bumping up against our limitation of talking too much. Let's bring on the guests who are much more interesting.
Yes.
To us.
We are joined today by Doug Pasco and Adam Schlagman. Hello, gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. Doug, why don't you tell the kids at home a little bit about yourself?
Well, I'm a new comic book writer with Adam Schlagman here, and also a film and television producer.
Very nice. And Adam?
Sure. Well, first off, congratulations on that very sexy award.
Right?
So sexy. It's beautiful, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we're. Yeah. I think I'm going to take her out to dinner later. But
yeah. You should just, anytime you go to eat, out to eat, you should just bring it with you. I feel like people.
Yeah. Get that killer Telly Award discount. popular. I believe they offer that at Applebee's. I'm pretty sure.
Love nice. It.
But yeah, so I'm
but Adam. Yeah, tell us a little about yourself.
Yeah. Sorry. Adam Schlagman. I'm a writer as well, co-writer with Doug on a project we'll be talking about later with you. Also the head of studio and executive editor at Panic Entertainment.
Very nice. Very nice.
Big fans of, go ahead.
No, I was going to say Panic is brand new this summer, right? I may have gone to a launch party or announcement at Comics Pro. I think there was something like that. But I know Chris Longo has been talking about it for a while, and Chris told us about it and told us that it would be fun and interesting to talk to you guys about the new comic, which is called Tama. And that's coming out when?
Tama's out August 6th in comic shops everywhere across the country.
Nice. And digitally as well, I assume.
Yes. It'll be available on Global Comics.
So how did you two guys specifically come together to do this project? Doug, you want to take it?
Yeah.
So how did we meet or get this going? Is that was the question?
Yeah. What is the foundation? What is the backstory of this project and you two guys working together?
I think us working together is probably the first part. So I was doing a television show for the CW and was over on the Warner Brothers lot a lot. And then through mutual friends, acquaintances, came across this guy doing some pretty cool stuff over there, and we got to chatting and ended up becoming very fast friends. But then this idea came along, you know, months or actually years later from that. And Adam and I were sitting at our local Starbucks by the Warner Brothers lot having coffee, and he's like, "What if?" Mm-hmm. That's where this started. So I don't know if you want to jump into the specifics of the what if, but.
And was the what if always that it would be a comic book, or was it going to be a show for a minute, or what was the original idea?
I think we were always thinking comic book. Obviously, we've both done, you know, film and television stuff, but you know, the comic medium just allows you to do anything. It can be as incredible as you want it to be. So we wanted to start there so we could tell the story we wanted to tell. And then if it fits into a comic or a movie, that's fantastic. Sure. But I want to make sure we have a fantastic comic first.
Yeah, and I always feel like having witnessed a lot of comics get adapted or try to be adapted, it's, you can never just make a comic in order for it to be adapted. It doesn't work. It needs to work as a comic book. It needs to be a great comic. It can't just be this idea that you want to adapt. So, and again, if it doesn't work as a comic, it's never going to, maybe you can get an option, but it's never going to get made into this great movie or TV show or animated series or anything.
I think people do know the difference. And I will say, even studio executives know the difference between a story someone really wanted to tell and a pamphlet advertising a possible potential comic book movie or television show. I get that question a lot. I know Ryland gets that question a lot. People are like, yeah, my pilot, I can't get it made. Should I make a graphic novel? And I always say the same thing. Are you going to love it when it's just a comic book? Like, is it being a comic book enough for you? Are you behind that, or is this just a brochure? The brochures always fail.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I get them sometimes, and they feel like they were done. They were comics done with a regulator on. I mean, because I come from the film and television business also, and I wrote for, I don't know, probably about 12 years in Hollywood before I crossed over to comics. I'd wanted to cross over to comics for a really long time, but as I was writing, like, what Hollywood did was just shrinking almost every day, you know? And I felt like I got to about 12 years and I was sort of in this corner where every job I went up for felt almost exactly the same, you know? And you know, they were writing about five different kinds of movies. They wanted them written a certain way. And so brochure guy goes and does that, but he does it in a comic book. And the reason that I crossed over into comic books was that it was so freeing. Like I got to 12 years and I looked around and I hate to be the guy that gets paid to write film and TV, because that guy's an idiot. But I was, it just felt like a trade at some point. It felt like I was laying bricks and I did not feel like creatively stimulated anymore. And I looked around and I'm like, I don't know if I can do this for another 12 years. But comics, you know, allowed me to do anything and everything. It was just like, if it is good, you can do it. And you can do it any way you want to do it. It's not like, no, don't do that. No, don't take the spin off that ball. No, don't do anything. It was just, so when I got into comics, it was like, oh my God, I can do that. Oh wow, I can do that. And so when I, you know, so I made the promise to myself that I was never going to tell an A to B to C story. It was like, I am going to play with structure and play with point of view and use unreliable narrators and experimental elements. And it was just like, it was a Ferrari and I did not get in it and go 25 miles an hour in the right lane. I put the pedal down and I tried to see what she could do. And so I feel like brochure guy does not realize that he's in a Ferrari.
No.
And sometimes you literally think you're looking at a pitch deck that someone drew.
I'm reading
a pitch deck. Had either of you written comics before this?
I have. I was at DC for about 20 years before starting the Panic Venture. So I was an editor there during the Blackest Night days.
Green
Lantern, and then from there I went on to be a film exec and a executive producer on a bunch of the Warner Brothers DC movies.
Okay.
And so during all that time, I got to write a few things. I wrote the Flashpoint, Hal Jordan and Flashpoint Abin Sur miniseries.
Nice.
And then I wrote a Batman Brave and Bold issue, an Untold Tales of Blackest Night story, some other small stories and some specials here and there. So I've definitely dabbled in the comic book writing, which I love. And I mean, comics, I grew up reading comics. Like comics was my joy as a child. And it was something I always wanted to do. So it's been a great ride.
that's great. I mean, I my origin story, I never thought of comics as a thing that I would do. I was a film guy for years and years and years, but I always loved them. I always thought they were great. Mm-hmm. It just wasn't until someone said to me, "Do you want to write comics?" And I went, "Yes, I do." But you know, when you're pursuing anything in the arts, every medium, every career is just one more hill to climb and one more locked door in front of you. So choosing another locked door is not always the easiest way to go. But if someone opens the door for you, or even tells you that they might answer it if you knock, that, you know, that can be very powerful. Doug, I'm just curious, what was the CW show you were on when you started working with Adam or when you met Adam?
I was producing The Outpost. It was a fantasy medieval show for CW. Well, like about four seasons. It was pretty good time. Enjoyed that. But this is definitely my first foray into comics and a big learning curve for me, you know, because coming from like very visual mediums, like, oh, this will be great. I can tell any story I want. And then to kind of like pump the brakes and I've had to sort of explain to me the structure of how you tell a story in this medium, which is like a lot of learning. It was fantastic to learn it, but I was like, okay, wow, right? this is not what I was expecting. And how, you know, like, things don't move on the page. I have to figure out how to tell the story from panel to panel.
That is,
and like, have you imagine what has happened between the panels?
Yeah, that is the editing 101 thing I have to tell new comic book writers, is that you get one action per panel. And the thing you always see is Matt Murdock walks in the room, throws down his keys on the counter and turns on the TV. And you're like, that's four panels. There's an elegant way to convey all that information in one panel. You know, Matt's hand and the keys in the foreground and the TV going on in the background and the door open in the background and all. Like, there are ways to do that. And you learn those ways the more you get. But I'm with you, Doug. Like, I started writing comics at 49. And it was really invigorating to be like a freshman art student at 49 years old to go like, oh, I got to learn a whole new medium. I got to learn a language of storytelling and art. And I think if I had started it when I was 20, I might not be as obsessed with getting page turns right as I am as a middle-aged man. Like, there's going to be something interesting is going to happen on every goddamn page turn. I got upset when it was explained to me. I was like, that's the engine that drives the whole thing. Wow. Never thought about that before. Never noticed it. Even though it's there in everything I love.
Mm-hmm. I feel like there were times Doug probably wanted to kill me because I was like, we have to do page breakdowns for every issue. We got to make sure that all the page turns are, and then the splash pages are on the left hand page. And
I feel like the film TV background, I mean, for me, it was mostly A+. And so one of the things I have started to do on the side is that I teach kids at the Los Angeles Film School how to do this. And I have found that they take to it much more easily than do, you know, your average Joe off the street. I mean, these are people that are getting a world-class visual storytelling education. And I don't know, maybe it's because they're not like old dogs that are fucking set in their ways like we are, but they understand. They understand immediately. It's like, it is kind of like a different formula, I guess. I don't know if that's the right word for it, but you know, a slightly different process, but it's like, but man, these guys take to it. And you know, I mean, I was a directing fellow at the American Film Institute Conservatory for whatever that's worth. But the transition for me was just like, okay, well, I've directed all this stuff, and it's like, well, so a screenplay is a screenplay. It's just the story. But it's like, well, mm-hmm. a comic book script is, well, it's the screenplay, but it is also everything that I would prep for my collaborators, my cinematographer, my production designer, my costumer. It just all goes in there. It's just like, it's kind of the script and director's notes. And
exactly. I always say you're the writer and director in the script, in a way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you're making a shot list right there. And so one of the panels that has like, Abalone and I do a lot of panels at cons. And one of the panels that like has always been a big hit is I do the directing your comics panel. And we did it at San Diego a couple of years, and that was always a really interesting thing. And you sort of cast the comic book writer as the director of his or her own movie. And you know, in the artist, the colorist, you got your cinematographer, the metaphor becomes a meta five at some point, and it is no longer useful, but you know what I mean? And there has been so much crossover, you know, particularly I think in recent years, that it is always really interesting to get kind of like three or four really talented writers that worked in the film business heavily and get them up there and talk about how.
Oh no.
Oh, we lost Ryland. I'm sure he will be back. I do find I was in one of the main sections of film I was in was post-production, and the post-production process always, I feel like it was useful to me to have gone through that, because talking about Ryland's Meta 5, you know, you can't, and this is true of making a film, you can't write it or direct it and then walk away, and whatever the editor does, whatever the sound guy does, whatever the colorist does, that you have, you know, the lettering pass is the sound mix, the colorist is the color mix, and having the experience of shepherding something through all of those stages, I think is useful if you've been a producer or a director in film. Mm-hmm. Sorry, Ryland, if you want to wrap up your thought.
Oh yeah, I don't even know where I was, but yeah, I mean, you're making a great point where it is like, it is about project management. I think that when you're doing one of these things, and particularly, you know, like, I mean, Adam is running a publishing company right now, and shepherding all these other people, and I think that it does become an exercise in project management when you're producing a show or you're making a movie or whatever you're doing. It's like these are just exercises in project management, and that project management stuff is universal. So it's like, I need to hire the right collaborators, I need to manage them, I need to not step on their artistic process. It is just all that stuff, and then you're making this thing that is meant to be, you know, it is art, it is entertainment. It is a commercial product, It is all of these things. And so I think that that skill set is applicable to, I mean, I, you know, with my teaching, I mean, one of the things that I'm working on right now is, the Department of Labor has these apprenticeships, that, you know, basically they will, you know, they'll pay you to bring on apprentices that learn how to do what you do. And that's a really interesting program, but it's like, but in talking with them, you know, the easy thing is like, oh, I'm going to bring people on. I'm going to teach them to make a comic book from kernel of an idea to finished product that's going out to a comic shop or a backer on Kickstarter or something like that. And that sounds awesome. But it's like, really what it is not a comic book making apprenticeship. It is a project management apprenticeship where you learn these skills that are applicable to literally any business endeavor that you're going to take on. And I think that's so interesting to me. And we do this over and over and over again, you know, like with Doug, like, you know, if you're producing a show, whatever, the studio says, we want 23 of these and this, you know, obscenely short amount of time, like bring them back to us. And then you gotta hire a couple of hundred people to make that happen. Like that, it's a miracle that it happens and that it happens so often.
Yeah, I mean, you hit it on the head. I always say that a comic book editor is a producer of comics. They don't call them that, but it's the same thing. You're there from every step of the way, like the inception of the idea through the outlines, the scripts, the artwork, the lettering, and then at the end of the day, you're responsible for the final book.
In some ways, it's a little bit harder doing the comic book side, just because at producing things, I had all these other people to interact with and offer my guidance and or insight or thoughts about something, and they would do the thing. And then I'm sitting there with Adam, and I'm like, no, it's us doing the thing. All the things are for us.
No, I will say sometimes there are so many people, right? There's a lot more politics are involved.
True.
Yeah. Well,
this is exactly, you know, what we wanted.
Yeah. I will say that the interesting thing about a comic book, in terms of you generally don't have a costume designer, you don't have a production designer, you're putting all of that has got to come from either the writer or the artist. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, you know, like some of it, production design costume will come from the colorist, you know, some design elements will come from the letterer, but you're having to do a lot more things. I think that's the point you were getting to there, Doug, of you can't just, when the artist says, what is Betty Page wearing? I can't say, let's call the costume designer into the room and she can show me some options. I have to go, let me look at a Vogue magazine from 1953 and send you a screen grab, because that's what Betty Page is going to be wearing. I don't have someone, I use that example because, of course, I'm married to a costumer and she does help me sometimes and receives credit in comic books. She has designed costumes for Betty Page in the comic books. Luckily, Elvira just has that one dress. So, you know, that limits the amount of fashion designer work I need on those comics.
Yeah. I mean, when we did Fasheng Origins for Immortal Studios, and that's actually on Kickstarter right now too. So yeah, I probably should have pimped that in the beginning. Go get Fasheng Origins #3. But that takes place in China during the Boxer Uprising right around 1900. And, you know, very talented artist drawing it, but I got to tell them, I got to become an expert on what China looked like in 1900. And I'm referencing real battles that have, you know, very specific regional armies fighting them and groups fighting in them and, you know, foreign actors and all that stuff. And man, I had to become an expert in everything. And so those scripts, you know, talk about just like saturated with links and stuff like that. But at the same time, so you have Shaolin monks fighting. And that has to look a certain way. They can't just be punching and kicking. Shaolin monks from this region at this time, they fight a very specific way. And so luckily we had this guy, Jin Cheng, who was actually a 32nd generation Shaolin disciple who studied at the actual Shaolin temple. And so, you know, I'm a martial artist, but my, you know, my belts are in Tang Soo-do, which is Korean, and Okinawan karate, and American Kenpo. And so that doesn't look anything like Shaolin, but what I could do is be like, okay, you know, then he runs up and they fight and in giant block letters, I would write Gene question mark, question mark, question mark. And it was maybe the one time in comics where I could send my script over to, we literally had a fight coordinator on the book. And so, and Gene Ching is also the editor of Kung Fu Tai Chi magazine. And I don't know if you've ever read the magazine, but they are known for, they have these kind of how-to sections of each issue. And so it's like, here's a defense set. And so they do these like step-by-step, for years they've done them since I was a kid, but it's like, all right, you move in, then you pull down, then you, and so Gene has for like a couple of decades been an expert at breaking this stuff down into individual static images to teach people. So we find the perfect guy. And so, when there's this exchange of blows between a Shaolin monk and someone else, Gene will literally just, he'll grab his sparring partner that day, and he'll have somebody grab an iPhone, and he will break it down into individual still photographs for us. Those go to the artists, and then he draws them. And that's like, but it kind of felt like making a movie,
Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah.
So what was the, Adam, I think you said you had originally had the idea for Tama and you brought it to Doug at Starbucks.
So for Tama, so it was just, originally it was just a soup. It was one line. It was, what if your virtual pet that you've neglected for years comes back to kill you? It's like a Tamagotchi, sure. A Neopet, a Pokemon, whatever, but all those things that we stopped feeding or caring about back in the day. And so I pitched that to Doug and we were talking, and then we just kept throwing ideas back and forth off of each other. And then it evolved into what it is now.
And where was Panic in existence yet when you guys started kicking this around?
No, actually we ended up. So how it ended up at Panic is, we created the full pitch, included a 6-issue breakdown. And then we ended up, I was meeting with Chris just to talk about stuff in general. Chris Longo, sorry, who's the publisher.
Sure.
And I was telling him about this, and he's like, oh, that would be perfect for Panic. And then we sent it over. And during this process, he's like, oh, why don't you just be part of the Panic team too that we're building out? And I joined on anyway. But during the process, he read it, and their one real note was like, we want it to be dark, like more horror, more. And so so we went back through it, did a pass, and then they were like, green light.
Great. And it's going to be their first book, right? On stands, I think.
Yeah. So it's out August 6th. Panic's debut launch title. And then from there, that one's 6 issues. And then from there, we have another book launching in September called Black Diamond. And then another book launching in October called Savager. Those are both 4-issue minis. So by October, we'll have 3 a month.
Are you, either of you writing on those other two books, or do those have other teams?
Those are other teams. So Black Diamond is Brendan Columbus, who did Savage Circus for Heavy Metal, and teamed with Danilo Beirut, who's really, really great artist. And then it's Dirk Blackman and Shannon Eric Denton on Savager alongside Huber Ball.
Great Huber Ball.
Dynamite. He's fantastic.
Huber has drawn, I think, 10 comics for me. I'm trying to remember how many times we worked together, but just Huber is one of those guys, like whatever I throw him, I put some there. We did an Elvira book where I needed him to faithfully recreate about 40 different actors who have played Dracula over the years. Cause the main plot is Vlad the Impaler entering vampire movies and kidnapping the Dracula and bringing them into the real world so he could have an army of his own Draculas. And I could just like send him a page with 20 likenesses on it, and it would come back and I would go, that is Dwight Frye from 1933 Dracula. That's amazing. So I would send him photo reference, of course, but that guy, there was like nothing he couldn't do. And I was so impressed with him. Where did you find the artist for Tama?
Yeah, so Tama's Daniel HDR, who's done Masters of the Universe. He actually did Digimon back in the day, which is probably the most related to our stuff. But that was one of his first projects. And then he's done a bunch of DC books, some Marvel books, and other stuff as well, but he's a Brazilian artist. Mm-hmm. We were connected with through Joe Prado, who's his agent, who I used to work with back in the day. He repped Ivan Reese and also did his own work for us as he was an anchor on Blackest Night as well. So he's a
I'd like to say I think we lucked out on all three of Panic's launch titles. We got like great artists that fit perfectly with each of those comics. I mean, I don't know what the process is being new to the comics, but I was just like, wow, these artists are exactly right for each of these titles. So I've been very happy, especially with Daniel, of course.
Daniel's stuff is it's what we wanted, which is like this mix of almost like kind of slight manga feel to it, but not mm-hmm. quite. It still feels American in art style.
Yeah. Yeah, I read it before we spoke, and I thought the art was really great. I feel like it really captured what you were trying to get across. And that combination of the cuteness with the sort of photoreal ultra violence and all that is quite a look. And it's really something unique. And I really look forward to where you can take it from mm-hmm. here after after that first issue.
It was up to all the challenges too, because there's a lot in these comics where you can't always see the creature because of the context of things in the comic. So he had to draw a lot of things where the things are happening, but you can't actually draw the creature in the frame. So it's a challenge accepted, and he conquered it well. So
give me a little more detail on the book too. Because I don't think we elaborated on how where it went to from that initial one-line pitch or whatever, but it's
that's true.
It follows this kid who's dealing with grief. He lost his father recently, and his mom hasn't been able to deal with losing her husband, so she's just throwing herself into work and ignoring him. So he's all by himself, neglected, kind of like these creatures were back in the day, right? And so so he finds this defunct virtual pet system, and he activates it, and he activates this creature Tama, who's like super cute. You can see him behind me on my screen over here. He's like crossed between like a cat and a raccoon. And it's everything he's always wanted, because he's also allergic to animals. So he's never had a dog or cat with him. And so it's something that like loves him unconditionally and pays attention to him. And then bad things start happening around him. Because this creature is also dealing with its own trauma. And so it's really about these two characters trying to overcome their trauma together. But when the creature takes things too far, the kid needs to realize that he has to shut down this one thing that seems to love him.
Yeah, it's a monkey's paw / genie situation a little bit, where don't mm-hmm. say a wish out loud when you have an implacable digital monster that does whatever you say. I love... One of the ideas from the comic that I really loved, and I'm not a Pokemon guy at all, so I have never had a digital avatar thing like that. The happiness level idea, that you don't want your digital pet's happiness level to go to zero, because what will it then do? Mm-hmm. And I love that moment in the comic, not to spoil anything. But is that a feature of Pokemons and things like that? I'd never run across that before.
No, there's a... Like in Pokemon, they could at some stage they can evolve, but it's just based on levels, which is more tied to traditionally just them defeating other Pokemon, things of that nature. I don't think there's like just keeping them happy. I think like Tamagotchis and everything with food and things, but I don't think they had a level thing where they're reaching zero, like this thing's gonna be pissed off or anything.
Yeah, I just thought that was a really fascinating idea, having a visual monitor of something as intangible as happiness, and that you have to worry about the happiness monitor, which is, it's like living with a sociopath, living with an abuser, essentially.
Mm-hmm. I have an 8-year-old, and she was gifted a Tamagotchi maybe about 2 years ago, and quickly fell in love with it, and attended to it, all the time. And then at some point she got bored with it and it went in a drawer. And we all have had this thing, but at some point it it didn't get angry, you know what I'm saying? But it was beeping a lot because it was unhappy and it needed to be fed and it needed this and it needed that. And you know, I think we've all gotten to the point where it's like, well, at some point you take the batteries out of it. It was just it. So it's funny seeing the book because I got it immediately because literally I had just had this arc happen to me, you know, probably 2 years ago. And I'm like, this is a really good, you know, and it's like, what if that was a horror movie?
Everyone will relate because we had them back in the day. They're back again now for the younger generation. And exactly that. It's like, you know, I had some of them. I even had one of those Furbies, which was actually the worst. Like,
I'm old enough that it mostly reminded me of a Furby, actually. That was the, that was my touchstone more than Pokemon or Tamaguchi because that's just little beyond my time.
And now with AI and all of the things that AI is capable of doing, nothing that happens in the comic is sort of, you know, unrealistic in terms of what, you know, an AI powered entity might learn or want to do. So it's, it's really interesting to like really explore that in this medium.
That's scary.
Yeah. We're trying to use the comic. We're trying to use the medium to that regard where it only really works in a comic where we have a, we'll have some panels that are side by side where one is the real world and then one's like the VR AR world because you can only see the creatures in that world. So you'll have so for instance there's one where they're playing together in this like floor is lava game or something and the creature swinging on a towel, but then you'll go to the other panel where it's just him playing but then the towel is still swinging, so you're like, why is that happening? Why is it able to actually interact with the real world?
Yeah. I don't know if you guys saw this. There was a great article. Someone, I can't even remember what the prompt was. Oh yeah. A writer asked a ChatGPT character to read his articles and select essays for his, for like a promo packet. And as it goes along, the thing just starts telling him outrageous lies about what's in his own writing. And when caught, it apologizes. It says, I violated your trust. And then it tells more lies. And it's just, and this isn't science fiction. This isn't Michael Crichton. This is a guy dealing with an actual chatbot that people actually use. And it's saying, well, yeah, the way you referenced Madonna in that essay, he's like, okay, I never mentioned Madonna in that essay. So I don't know, like, so that's terrifying that you read. And then he's like, well, and then the bot goes, well, I told you I read your essays. I really wasn't able to access them. So I made assumptions based on the titles. And it's just,
wow.
You know, it's just this, the thing doesn't have a body. It can't come to life and strangle you. It can't rip your heart out at your desk in Silicon Valley. But it's kind of terrifying to like, it's if HAL 9000 was a one-year-old, like with no memory of what it just said to you, no ability to track its own lies and make them consistent, which is the definite, like that's a psychopath. And that we're creating these like digital psychopaths. So
we,
I think
we don't have more of those in this world.
Yeah. It's a pretty, what's the word? It's a pretty timely story to be telling.
Yeah.
About the digital artifact, you know, wanting to kill you, feeling neglected.
The AI thing is so terrifying. It's like, you know, we all grew up with like, you know, oh, grandma turned 102 today. And in the time she's been alive, she saw this happen, then this happened, and this happened. And when she was 8, she never could have imagined that you could fly across the Atlantic and all, you know, like, that has always been a thing, right? Measuring that in like 50, 80, 100 years. But like, we are to the point now with this stuff that we're talking about where we don't know what the world is going to look like in 5 years because of this stuff. Like that's how quickly this shit is progressing. And like what jobs are going to be eliminated and what kind of, you know, pets and virtual assistants we're going to have and all of that stuff. I mean, that is what people are looking at now. They're like, in 5 years, none of us might be, you know, it might be that none of us is driving, you know? And it becomes this interesting thing. I was listening to a guy talk and he was saying like, well, we've never been at this point in our lives. Cause again, I have an 8-year-old. I don't know if you guys have kids, but But go back even a little further. Like, let's say you have a four-year-old, and in almost every case up until now, you're looking at your four-year-old and you knew exactly, there was this handful of things you knew that your four-year-old needed to know to navigate the world, right? When we were younger, we needed to know how to drive. We needed to know how to read. You know, there are a couple of other basic things that you know you need to know to navigate the world. We don't know what those are right now. Like,
And we never will.
But one of the things we do know, I'll finish up that thought, is we are way slow in teaching children how to, and teaching adults how to navigate the digital world. Like, the thing that we do know at the moment is grandma's got to learn how to recognize a scam, and the four-year-old's got to learn how to recognize a scam. Grandma and the four-year-old have to be taught not to pick up the phone when you don't recognize the number, and not to answer a text, and not to, you know, and some of it seems so transparent, but on the other hand, you have to go, this has to be working on someone or they wouldn't be doing it. Yep. Like, all of those wrong numbers you get from 20-year-old Japanese girls, apparently. Every time I get one, I'm like, I'm sorry for you that this isn't my fetish, so I'm not going to fall for it. Like, this isn't the, find me a cute middle-aged nerd lady and have her accidentally, you know, I thought this was Sarah. You know, whatever. But if I'm getting, you know, 20 of those a week, it just stands to reason that someone out there in the world is giving one of those 20-year-old Japanese girls his credit card number.
Oh, I mean, my mom and dad almost lost their life savings to one of these little internet scams. Like, it was so good too. So I get it.
No. And they also, they pray, you know, it's like the one that's going around now about toll evasion. That works because there are enough people out there like, oh yeah, did I pay that? Like, they're preying on a completely natural thing that people are like, oh, I was on the freeway the other day and the thing beeped. Mm-hmm. Did I forget to reload that? I got to pay that. So, like, if you already feel, there's a thing in Kafka, and I think William Burroughs repeated it, about how a truly effective oppressive society works is you don't even, the people oppress themselves. It's partially what the trial is about. It's that you can tell someone they're under arrest, and instead of them saying, that's absurd, I haven't done anything, they go, which of the thousand regulations that I know exist that I'm not sure about, could I, like, that you start prosecuting yourself and persecuting yourself and oppressing yourself. You're like, well, I'll give you an example from my own life. The IRS made a terrible mistake in processing one of my returns 20 years ago, because I have been off and on bad at filing my taxes on time. I didn't double check them. And I had, like, a year later, I dug into and went, whoa, 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 whoa. I don't owe you guys anything. You took a W-2 that said $4,900 and processed it as $49,000. And suddenly I owed you taxes on $49,000 that I somehow made in 3 weeks as the first AD on an independent film. But I already believed I was guilty. You know what I mean? I was all like, well, I fucked up my taxes enough. I'm sure they're right about this. Let me get my accountant on it. And before the accountant got around to it, I looked at the papers and went, wait a minute. This is just a common, like, they moved a decimal point in the wrong direction and screwed me over. And I think there's a medical, lot of that going on.
Even medical bills, I feel like they just send them to you and then they haven't gone through your insurance yet. And then you're like, oh, I owe $1,000. But then if you call your insurance, they're like, oh, we haven't paid it yet. You're going to owe $50 or whatever. But if you don't pay attention, you're going to pay them the $1,000 and no one's going to say anything.
I was a victim of a violent crime once. And in the ambulance, this was at a time when I had no health insurance. In the ambulance, I sort of gently asked, what is this going to cost me? And he went, well, you're a victim of violent crime. Actually, they're going to take this out of the person who assaulted you. But they are going to send you angry letters about the $700 you owe for a year before the courts intervene and say, oh no, we collected this from the guy with the knife, so don't worry, you're cool. He said, like, it's gonna be painful for you to ignore all of those letters, but ignore all of those letters because that's just the system. But all this to say, I will say one more thing about the AI thing, and then we can, you know, move on to a more pleasant topic. But part of the problem comes from that one of the most interesting things about human beings is you can draw a straight, and it's about cartooning. You can draw a straight line and two dots on a paper, and we are, no other animal on earth goes, that's a face. We are programmed weirdly to pick up a human face anywhere. Part of the problem with AI is people are seeing a human face when what they're getting is autofill. When what they're really getting is a machine that goes, the sentence that people usually reply to this with is this. It is not actually thinking. It is not actually applying intelligence. It is looking at 1,000 texts and going, when someone asks knock, knock, the correct thing that people usually say in response is who's there. It does not know that you're knocking on a door, and it does not know that the who's there is the person on the other side of the door. It doesn't know it's a setup for a joke until you do the next part. It's spicy autofill. That's all it, 99% of this is it's autofill, and that's why so much of it is junk, because all you have to do to destroy it, and it's funny that we've literally landed on Captain Kirk from original Star Trek. You can destroy AI models by feeding them gibberish. because they will then respond with gibberish, because they're like, oh, the correct answer to knock knock is cold soup. So if you put that on the internet 1,000 times, you will reach a point where AI is going to go knock knock cold soup. And no one's going to believe that's intelligence. They're just going to go, mm-hmm. Oh, that's some weird reflex thing. Anyway, that's my I see a lot of thing. It's like when people call it hallucinating. Hallucinating is what human beings do. What AI is doing is supplying the wrong answer because it doesn't understand the question. That's a very, very different thing from hallucination. Mm-hmm. But all this to say, this whole topic is that the idea of a digital artifact going mad from neglect. I mean, it's also taking it away from the digital. This is the scary version of Toy Story.
Yeah.
Instead of your toys becoming weepy and nostalgic when you neglect them, you know, the army men band together and start shooting their plastic rifles.
Well, it's like from the perspective of the neighbor kid in Toy Story that like glued them, like cut them up and glued them all together. Like it's like seeing it from their perspective.
Yeah. Exactly. There's that Captain Kirk action figure I set fire to in the eighth grade. It's coming for me at some point, I'm sure.
Well, it's funny you say that, though, because everything about Tama, like by the end, you're kind of rooting for Tama because you learn what's going on in Tama's universe and where Tama came from, what Tama went through. And like Tama's doing stuff, but you're like, man, I also kind of want Tama to win. So it's a tough journey.
I have said this. I this is something I strongly believe. One of the greatest signs of evolution in how human beings' minds work and how we process information, which one could call being woke or whatever, is that when they made Westworld in 1971, no one asked the question, what kind of disgusting, perverted, violent psychopath pays $100,000 for a weekend of raping and murdering robots? But when they rebooted the TV show, Jonathan Nolan went, the villains are absolutely the people who pay top dollar to murder a bunch of fucking robots who never did anything to the, you know, who are just innocent artificial intelligences running around, and they want to do nightmarish butchery on them for kicks. And it's people who wanted to get away with a crime are who visits Westworld. You know, like, and I really think it's a good sign for human culture that when they came to reboot Westworld, someone went, why are the robots angry? What are the robots mad about? Why did Yul Brynner want to kill Richard Benjamin? Oh, because he shot him about a dozen times before that. Like, that's actually Yul Brynner is having a pretty reasonable response to James Brolin shooting him 6 times, I think. I think we'd all do that if we were Yul Brynner.
Well, it is kind of a treatise on modern audiences also. You know, if we get the log line of Tama. You know, no matter, we're all writers, so we obviously start writing the story in our head very quickly, right? But what I will posit is that audiences are smarter than ever now, and they start writing it also, right? And so if you just give them that, you are doing them a disservice, right? But what a good writer is going to do is they're going to be like, I know exactly what they expect from me, and we're going to start to play with that, right? We're going to give them more. We're going to give them twists and turns. We're going to start to take them in that direction, and then we're going to yank them in this direction. And then that is where the art in the execution comes in, and that is the difference between people like flipping through it and being like, oh, yeah, you know, and people being like, oh, wow, I didn't see that coming. Give me issue 2, you know, and I got to tell my friends about it.
And for me, it's all about, like, everything's always about character. Like, story comes from character. And if you're in love with the main character, you're there for their journey. You want to see what happens. You're there no matter what. So like, we had to make sure we created a really compelling character that you're rooting for, and also a compelling villain who's also not really a villain there. So it's if you love them all, you want to know what's going to happen, even if it pulls at your heartstrings by the end or not.
Yeah. No, and look, and you know, the one thing movies and television have in their favor is you hire someone who is very attractive and monstrously charismatic, and it can paper over a lot of flaws. In comics, the version of that is having a really great artist. But ultimately, in both spaces, you got to create something for them to say, and you got to make them, you know, you got to make them people. You know, the success of most media, especially television, but comic books as well, is, do you want to spend time with these people? Do you care about them? My when we were walking out of Star Trek VI, which was, you know, the last one with all of the main crew members, I remember my sister turning to me and saying, so they retire for, like, can the next one be Kirk and Spock and McCoy go golfing? I just want to hang out with them for another 2 hours. Like, they don't have to save the universe. Like, how about they, you know, they work in Kirk's garage fixing his motorcycle, and that's, you can get away with that if you have characters that people care about. You can have them doing anything, and it's intrinsically interesting to the audience, you know, and that's that comfort. And then, of course, you got to play with that comfort, and you got to find ways to make them uncomfortable and surprised. And, you know, what's the magic formula is, a story has to feel inevitable and surprising at the same time. And that's,
Did you guys watch Breaking Bad?
Yeah.
So there's there's that one scene where it's Jesse and Cranston and his wife both eating dinner, but the two of them want to kill each other at the moment. But it's just this super awkward, but it's hilarious because of it's so awkward moment I love it. Like, it gets me every time. And so, like, we tried to inject a couple things like that into the book as well.
Yeah, and you know, it's what also helps a scene like that, as we were talking about, is you can understand, you know, all three characters' perspectives, you know what they're all thinking, and you know that it's completely at odds with what you're seeing and what they're saying. Yep. The greatest magic trick I think you can do as a writer, honestly, is when the audience can absolutely understand what the character is thinking without them having to say a word. You know, when you've written the character so well in the past that you can cut to a close-up and the actor makes a face and the audience goes, oh, he figured it out. Oh, he's going to kill that guy.
We challenge ourselves for this too, because a lot of times, obviously, there's you do captions, right, for the main character, especially if there's no one around for them to talk to. So you kind of have to at moments. Yeah. But we purposely didn't do captions in this book because we wanted to try to get all that across.
When I started, I didn't use captions at all, because I was going for a completely cinematic feel. And if it wasn't on the audio track, my feeling went, I don't want to use it. And then the main artist I was working with at the time was a guy named Dave Acosta. And he said, use captions sometimes, man. Let comics be comics. But it really depends on the comic.
100%.
There are comics that work great without captions and make you and that makes you meet it halfway. And there are also comics where like not having captions would so slow down the storytelling, where you'd have to show everything that happens, and you know, and sometimes it's great to just be able to say, 2 weeks later, I woke up in a hospital, you know, and not have to go like, here. It's funny. Ryland just gave me this note on something that I'm writing where I showed a guy recovering from something and he was like, can we just get to the part where he's recovered? Cause I don't care about this page. And he was absolutely right. I kind of wanted to.
That is one of the great things about comics too, I feel like, is it's like,
yeah,
you just put 2 weeks later
and you're yeah, there. Exactly. Exactly. And it's also one of the most interesting things I had happen with comics is with captions is I did an omniscient narrator for the first time in a Zorro book. And in the third issue on the last page, he meets the Tongva, the local Los Angeles tribe, goddess of death, whose name was Tarmalok. And as soon as she opened her mouth, I went, oh, this hasn't been a random omniscient narrator. This has been Tarmalok, the goddess of death, telling us this story from the beginning. And I you know, wrote the letter and said, Tarmalok's dialogue should actually have the same font, treatment, and coloring as the caption boxes, so the audience knows they are now in the presence of the person who's been telling the story. I did not plan that. I created a sort of poetic, interesting voice for the narrator because I thought that was a good voice. And then when we got to her, I went, oh no, this is, she's the one telling us this story about Zorro. It's her story about Zorro. It's her story about the time she met Zorro. Got it. Now it all makes sense. And because she's the goddess of death, she doesn't need to have been present to have narrated all of those other scenes, you know?
Yeah. How do you guys normally write your stuff? Like for instance, Doug and I like to do a pretty detailed outline of everything and then do page breakdowns for each issue as we go, but we even like break down up the theme and the characters and make sure everyone has arcs and all that stuff. So like it gets pretty like it's pretty baked by the time we're actually start writing. But even in that regard, like the story changed for Tama by the end because some characters we like started to really grow and like someone was just like a normal traditional bully and then we're like, that's boring, let's turn them into something really awesome, and now they're an amazing character by the end of it that hopefully the audience loves as much as we do. But but stuff like that, like, yeah.
I will find that, you know, I'm lucky with Dynamite is they will approve a pretty sketchy pitch. I am unlucky because they then want it immediately.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I haven't outlined it at all. And I will get to like issue 3 of a 5-issue series and go, what the hell was supposed to happen here? Like, I know what happens in issue 5. How was I? But I wouldn't say that I will say this. When I don't outline an individual issue, I regret it every single time. And I never do a whole outline, like a holistic outline. I do page breakdowns. I do page 1 through page 4, flashback to this thing. Page 5, 6, 7, this happens. Page 8, this conversation between these two characters. And I do that for the whole book. And when I've done that, I can write pretty quickly. But arcs for the whole series, I generally have internalized that stuff enough that I don't need to track it. Every once in a while, depending on the kind of story, like I'm Drawing Blood is a contemporary comedy drama. It's got no aliens, no monsters, no capes, no, it's got some gangsters in it. But like, that's one of the few times I will sometimes put scenes on index cards as if it was a screenplay because it doesn't. And of course, by the time you write out all the index cards, they only fit in one order. I have usually found like, I think, oh, well, I'll move them around. But then I go, huh, funny. I put them in the order I wrote them, strangely enough. But that's the only time in comics that I've done that screenplay thing of like, let me just write, come up with scenes and see, does this thing really have to happen before that thing or all of that? Ryland,
I approach it the same way I approach, teaching or public speaking, where I will plan what I'm going to say, but I do not plan how I'm going to say it or the order in which I'm going to say it. And that is that ends up being, because you know, I mean, in the film business, you naturally have to include a bunch of people as you're moving forward. You got to include the producer and the director and the executive, and so everything is way over planned. And you're right in that, like, well, you can execute a script from that very quickly, you know, which is helpful. And sometimes in comics, you know, again, if you're writing for DC or whatever, you often have to, you know, get there. When I do that too often, I end up with vanilla ice cream in the end. Maybe I end up with chocolate ice cream, which is pretty good. But I want fucking Rocky Road. I want, you know, chocolate cookie caramel swirl in the end. And so, again, I know what I have to say. I am writing about a historical figure right now. And so there's all this history I have to cover. And there's this big event that everybody knows about, has experienced one way or another. So it has to look a certain way, and things have to happen in a certain order to a degree. However, again, if I want to play with structure and, you know, and play with maybe how one person thinks it went one way and the other person thinks it went this different way, it is much more interesting to me. And I end up with something much more kind of challenging and wonderful, I think, in the end, if I just kind of like figure it out. Okay, well, let me start heading down this thing. And then I'm just going to start heading down this thing. And I'm writing pages 10 through 12. And then I go back and kind of chew on pages 3 and 4. And then I'm chewing on 13 through 14. And then in the end, you know, after kind of polishing and rearranging, then I end up with something that is really interesting. And something that I could not have planned in a million years, and that if I do it that way, I am most happy with what I end up with in the end. You sometimes have to do it the other way, but generally I'm kind of disappointed, and I wish I could kind of take it apart and put it back together.
It's funny, Adam. I think the only time we really struggled with where to put something was regarding a death of a character, which I won't tell you who dies or when. But we're like, where do we slot this in relative to what the audience is seeing? And it was a back and forth for a while there until we figured out the best combination. And then in the end, like you described with your projects, it's like, okay, now this is amazing. I'm so happy with how we've told this story with this person, this character dying.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was gonna say, Doug. The other thing is, I remember there were a few of the issues because we did break it down so much, but then when we break it down by the page for the issue, we're like, there's not enough awesome stuff in here yet. Like, so we just, we're like, it's not good enough. So we just challenged each other and like kept going back and forth and just making them as phenomenal as it could be. So, and like, that was really fulfilling seeing what we turned it into from what it was. Cause we already thought it was good, but now we're like, now it's actually great. And now we're like super proud of it and excited for people to check it out.
Yeah, you're gonna have a good story, right? But then it becomes about how do you present that story in the best way in terms of a comic book. Like, I, you know, when I'm teaching my students, I'm like, you gotta punch the reader in the face a couple of times every every issue, and so you can tell a story a certain way, and there are no face punches. You can go back, do it again, and it's like face punch right off the bat, face punch in the middle, face punch right at the end that leaves them aching and demanding the next issue.
That's what I call
it. Yeah. And I just remember writing the second issue of Aberrant, and the idea was like, basically this guy leaves the army to go investigate something. People inside the army are pissed off. They go out looking for him. Eventually they catch up with him at a bar. There's a big fight in the bar. Right. And so that was, when I did it the first time, that was how I wrote it. And it's like, well, this is a good story, and there are interesting things that he finds and stuff like that, but it's not, there's not tension in this, there's not whatever. And when I say punch the reader in the face a couple of times, sometimes I do that by showing somebody actually get punched in the face. And so what I did when I rearranged it was I went back, and panel number one is a close-up of a guy's face. And he's getting punched, teeth are flying out of his mouth. And right off the bat, you're like, oh shit, what did he just drop us in the middle of? And then there are a couple of pages of this clock cleaning fight. you see our protagonist, so you're finally grounded, being like, oh, it's him in the fight. But you have no idea where he is. You have no idea who he's fighting, why he's fighting them. You just know that all hell is broken loose and he's cleaning the fucking house. And then the story begins after that. You go back to the beginning and the story is about how the fuck is he going to end up in this fight? And so it adds all this tension, and the fight happens in a bar. And so when he's like, ah, let's go to the bar, you're like, no, don't go to the bar because you're going to end up in a giant fucking clock cleaning fight in the bar. And then when he's in the bar, there's the tension of when's the fight going to break out? The guy's in the background. Oh my God. Oh no, he doesn't see it coming. Simple change, but changed the entire landscape of the thing and went from just a normal A to B to C story to a script, an issue that was full of tension from start to finish, from fucking panel one. And that's awesome. And so I guess that's the kind of thing is like, well, I could have sat down and maybe tried to plan that and all that stuff. But when I planned it, I ended up with the first thing. And when I started kind of taking it apart and putting it together and just kind of, I don't know, going kind of artsy with it, then I ended up with something that was much more interesting and challenging.
Mm-hmm. I'm a big listener of audio commentaries on film DVDs. I think they're a lost art in some way. And one of my favorites is, believe it or not, on Diamonds Are Forever, because Guy Hamilton keeps saying, so in the script, Sean is supposed to fight a big fellow here. And well, we've seen it, haven't we? You know, and he talks about the fight with the two teenage girl gymnasts just being like, in the script, it was just some big dude and he was watching the Olympics with his wife and the gymnasts came on and he was like, these women are terrifying. Wouldn't it be funny to see big Sean Connery just get the ever-loving shit kicked out of him by two 90-pound girls, you know? And to me, that's a metaphor for any time you approach the situation where you're about to have Sean fight a big dude, you have to go. But we've seen that over and over and over. Yep. And the other scene in the movie that's like that is the fight on the elevator in the apartment building. That came from them taking an elevator. The production designer, Ken Adam, ironically, lived in a tiny, tiny little building. And the director and the screenwriter are stuffed in this elevator that barely two people can fit in. And he's like, wouldn't it be funny if Sean Connery and another guy who's 6'2" were trying to punch each other in this room? Like, you can't even do it. And the whole sequence is a very unique one because he thought these two guys just having a fist fight in a hallway is boring. What can we do to make it weird and funny and difficult? And, you know, so I think you always have to. Nothing makes me angrier than watching a TV show and, you know, the hero says, let's go, or we have company. It's like, surely, you know, that's been done, right? Like, surely there was another way to express that sentiment that wasn't let's go or we've got company.
Yeah. That's one of, I think that's the challenge. That's one of my pet peeves in comics and in movies, the exploding buildings. I'm like, you've seen it so many times. It doesn't in a comic, we've seen it. It doesn't need to be a giant splash page unless it's like super emotional ties to it. Sure. And same thing in movies. Like, we've seen everything get destroyed now, right? Like Independence Day was probably the first one that did it, and it was like, this is awesome, this is cool. And then everything since. So now it just doesn't have any weight anymore.
Yeah. You need to give it weight. It can't just be. And also the other thing, which is a post 9/11 thing, and this is particularly a pet peeve of mine, is they think the audience's appetite for destruction is so great that it outweighs the need to see the hero succeed. And boy, does that bug me. Man of Steel, Star Trek Into Darkness, and Skyfall all came out the same year. And in each one of the, Superman fails utterly to protect Metropolis. James Bond doesn't actually stop a guy from bombing London and killing M. And Captain Kirk lets Khan crash a starship into downtown San Francisco, killing hundreds of thousands of people. And I'm like, No, that's not. But we got them. It's like, yeah, at the end of Goldfinger, Goldfinger doesn't blow up Fort Knox, but James Bond kills him, so he wins. It's like, no, man, that's not winning. That's actually terrible. That's terrible, terrible losing. And if I want to see that, I will watch a documentary about 9/11. I don't. When I expect James Bond, Superman, and Captain Kirk to be able to prevent. You're not exciting me by showing me mass destruction. You're just fucking depressing me when Superman throws a guy through an office building and kills 500 people. But I knocked General Zod on his ass, so I guess that was worth throwing. The funniest one is the scene in Smallville. I think Mark Waid wrote a thing about it where he said, Clark, there's a cornfield like a block over. Why are you standing on Main Street when they're coming to get you, where the businesses and homes of everyone you grew up with is right there? Literally fly a block over, and it's all this place where you can destroy things and no one will get hurt. But that's just, you know, I hope that appetite for destruction goes away a little bit, because I think we're a little too excited seeing innocent civilians die in media. I'm not particularly on board with that as entertainment. Particularly in in heroic fantasy, I think it's particularly misplaced. But speaking of violence, when is the second issue going to be? It's August 6th. Is this going to be a monthly book?
Yeah, so it's going to be six issues monthly. Starts August 6th is issue one. It's available every 5 weeks so that retailers can make informed decisions based on how it's selling.
Sure.
And then it's available through retailers can order through Lunar, through the massive indie section, available through Diamond, and available through Universal distribution as well, which I think
that's good. I'm glad to hear that you guys, that Panic has made deals with Universal and with Lunar, because that was the big fear about the death of Diamond was that so many indie publishers, including my own, were still using it exclusively. So I'm glad things are moving forward with you guys and those distribution channels.
Yeah, well, it's everywhere, right?
It's a great book, and I look forward to reading the second issue. Something like 3 months on that.
I was going to say, let me vouch for the entire Panic catalog. You guys have put really great people together on everything. And if you love horror, if you love sci-fi, you like getting punched in the face by your comic books, I think you're in good hands, on this book and with the entire Panic catalog. So go out and get it. Chris and I are friends, and Chris has kind of slipped me some stuff, and I've just been kind of delighted by everything that he's given me. And go down to your local comic shop and celebrate the entire catalog.
Yeah,
no, thank you. Start here. I mean, it's all horror or dark sci-fi. That's our focus at Panic, because we just wanted to make sure we establish a brand. But they're all different types, right? I feel like horror goes into every genre at this point. And
it would probably be a bad idea for Panic to do a My Little Pony licensed idea. Like, it's called Panic. It's not called Relax. That's an appropriate thing.
I would absolutely write a horror version of My Little Pony.
Oh, sure.
License it.
Yeah. Friendship is terror. I think is the line there, or terror is magic, depending on which way you want to flip the switch on that. Doug, where can people find you online?
I'm on pretty much all of them, even Blue Sky, just Doug period Pasco. Sometimes my name without the period, but I try to be consistent with the Doug period Pasco on all of them.
Great. And Adam?
I'm mostly Instagram, and I'm just at A Schlagman.
Great. And do you guys have anything else you're working on right now beyond, I know Tama's, plenty to be working on, but are there any other projects you have in the world?
That'd be a whole different call. Yeah. We've got a lot of stuff we're working on. We'll hopefully be able to talk about a lot more of that soon.
Great. And yeah, Ryland, where
a couple more projects probably with Panic down the line.
With Panic.
As well as maybe some other things in the future too.
Terrific. And Ryland, where can people find you and what you got coming up?
I am at Ryland Grant on all forms of social media. That is RYLENDGRANT if you are just listening. I have to spell it because it's not a real name. My parents just kind of drunkenly arranged letters and saddled me with it. So now I have to spell it for you guys. You know, a lot in the works and a lot that I can't talk about too much, unfortunately. But the latest issue, the fifth issue of my Fargo-esque crime drama, The Peacekeepers, just finished up on Kickstarter. We're still taking late pledges, so go on over there and check that out. That is a banger. The third issue of my Wuxia Kung Fu epic Fa Sheng Origins is available on Kickstarter right now via Immortal Studios. That is another banger. A lot of bangers today. But that is worth checking out. Go see that campaign. The next thing from Half Evil Comics, I've talked about it the littlest bit, and I talked about it on another podcast, so I guess I should talk about it here. Is that my perhaps the title I am best known for, Banjax, which was my dark superhero noir that was originally released via Action Lab Entertainment, but it was nominated for 4 Ringo Awards. It was nominated for Best Series alongside books like Bitterroot and Something's Killing the Children. Great book, but Half Evil Comics has that back free and clear now, and we are bringing it onto the crowdfunding platforms. And so we have a World of Banjax series coming out called Sydney, which may very well be the next title. But Banjax is coming to crowdfunding. So I guess that's the little nugget of an announcement. But we are we got a lot of stuff. We are moving into licensed titles. Huge announcement coming at San Diego Comic-Con. It's going to blow some people's doors off. And I have found one or two other creators who do this better than me, and we are releasing their books. So the announcements on that stuff coming soon also. So check it all out at Ryland Grant, at Half Evil Comics. Go look up our wares.
Great. I look forward to all of that. And I am very easily Googled on all the social medias, David Avalone, D. Avalone. Website is davidavalonefreelance.com. And next up is Red Sonja Noir, I think next week. And buy it, because I'd like to do a second issue of that. It's a one-shot, but I pitched them another one-shot, and I think when it sells well, they will ask me to come back to it. Have a series coming out probably later this year called Two-Fisted Fairy Tales, which will be from Dynamite. Rylan and I are cooking up something together, which you'll hear more about down the road. Awesome. And yeah. Follow us, subscribe to HalfEvilComicsChannel. And thank you, Doug and Adam, for joining us.
It was great to be here. Thank you for having us.
Yep. Thank you guys so much. By the way, this is my first ever podcast. So.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
Well, yeah. You did really well. I have a date tonight.
And that's sexy.
I have this beautiful lady. So I'm going to take her out, treat her right.
Nice. Nice. All right. Take care, everyone.
Have a good one.
Thanks, everybody.
Take it easy, guys.
If you're watching us on YouTube, be sure to smash that like button. If you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts or other fine purveyors of ear crack, please leave us a 5-star review. And wherever you're watching and or listening, subscribe. We'll see you back here next week for more madcap hijinks on The Writer's Block.
For more information, visit pendantaudio.com. Thanks for listening.